It's a pleasure to be here, although many of you are on your way home or have already left, and I just arrived. I just arrived last night, actually, but I'm staying for a week. So I'm talking today about controlling atomic motion with light, and I'm going to give another talk, which is the ITP colloquium, next Wednesday, which will be about frontiers on controlling atomic motion with light. So this is sort of a warm-up talk for that one. Just to get started, and I should point out that this is an experimental talk, but I will try to mention some of the theory that lays behind this, is the tool that we are using for the most part to control atomic motion or molecular motion is the optical lattice. And when I say optical lattice, I mean interference pattern in space. It could be in one, two, or three dimensions or in time. And the simplest optical lattice that you could create is to just take two laser beams, counterpropagating, make an interference pattern with a period of half a wavelength. So you just get nodes and antinodes. Now, that idea actually has a long history. And this history goes back to Kapitsa and Dirac from 1933. They wrote a paper in which they called it diffraction of electrons from a standing wave of light. And I noted this was in the 7th Solvay conference because I gave a version of this talk a week ago at the 22nd Solvay conference. So it was relevant to mention this was 1933. But they proposed something which was quite revolutionary at the time. They said, suppose you have an electron impinging on a standing wave of light. What they predicted was that the electron would diffract from the light. This is a complete reversal of our notions of matter and light. Normally, people think of light diffracting from matter. And however, this was an extremely difficult proposal, although in 1933, they calculated the probability of diffraction, which was 10 to the minus 14, and they concluded that it was just on the verge of feasibility. So that's a warning to theorists who make predictions. And actually, Kapitsa is an experimentalist. But it took about almost 70 years to actually do this experiment conclusively with electrons. But it took less time to do with atoms. And the reason atoms are easier to work with than electrons is because they have resonances. And one can utilize those resonances to make the interaction with light particularly strong. Now, if you really want to make the interaction maximally strong, you can be very greedy and tune your laser exactly on resonance, so you have a ground and excited state. But the dominant process in that case will be absorption of light followed by spontaneous emission, which is an incoherent process in all directions. That's the price you pay for being greedy. If you're willing to be a little less greedy, you can tune away from resonance, and in some sense you get the best of both worlds, because you can have some detuning delta, which may be tens to thousands of line widths or even more. And in that regime, you can show that the probability of actual absorption becomes very small. It scales like 1 over delta squared. Whereas the effect of that laser is primarily to shift the level of the ground state. That shift is just proportional to the laser intensity divided by detuning. Well, if we have an energy shift and we have a gradient, obviously we get a force. And so if we come back to the simplest example that I gave of the optical lattice, then we realize that if we have an interference pattern of intensity varying periodically in space, then we get a corresponding potential for the atoms which does the same thing. It just tracks exactly like the intensity pattern. The KL is the wave number, 2 pi over the wavelength. So we can create potentials for atoms. And these potentials are essentially conservative, non-dissipative. And furthermore, we have a tool that we can use which is particularly convenient with atoms, and that is we can tune the sign of the force by either tuning to the red side or to the blue side of resonance. The way I've drawn it here, we are tuned below resonance, so this would be called red detuned. And in that case, the atom minimizes its energy by going into the light. Whereas if we tune to the blue side, if we tune above resonance, then it will be repelled from the light because it will minimize its energy by getting away from the light. And this, by the way, is the basis for the optical tweezer, which is used on a macroscopic object. So in fact, manipulation of matter with light is a very general approach. It only relies on a medium being polarizable. And the polarizability could be derived from a static polarizability, like in the case of a cell, or it could be a resonantly enhanced polarizability in the case of an atom. But in practice, one can use these dipole forces to manipulate anything. And I'll try to indicate in my talk, towards the end of my talk, what I mean by anything. And actually, that will be mainly the topic of my colloquium next week. But today, I will focus on atoms. And I will focus particularly on nonlinear dynamics and quantum mechanics, how they come together. Now, I want to revisit this potential for the moment. It's very sort of the simplest thing we can do, and ask, what is the classical motion of a particle, of an atom, in a standing wave of light? And I'm going to describe this classically in phase space. So for those of you who are not completely comfortable, let me try and make you comfortable in exactly 1 minute, which is probably impossible. But let's have a graphical representation of motion. So here's a particle moving in the standing wave. We have nodes and antinodes. The particle, in this case, will want to roll down the hill. We can represent that motion in phase space. In this case, we have P and we have X. X is taken in periods of one well. So this X equals zero in this case corresponds to the minimum of the well. And notice that we have lines. Those lines are constants of motion. That is, if you are on a line, you cannot cross it. And notice that you have concentric rings around that center. Physically, that corresponds to beam at the bottom and undergoing simple harmonic motion, where you're just exchanging position for momentum. But notice that there's special points here. That's this point and this one. Those are unstable fixed points. They correspond to being at the top of the wells, and those lines are called the separatrix. And if you are moving at some momentum that's below that, somewhere here, you will be confined in the well. But if you're moving faster than that, you'll never be confined in the well. You'll just be skimming over the tops. And notice that these lines bulge out because as you skim over the tops, you tend to speed up as you're approaching the bottom of the well and slow down as you're climbing the top. And if you go further out and out in momentum, these lines would eventually become straight because particle motion is unaffected by the well. So that just guides your intuition. However, that's not a very interesting case. The case I want to discuss is what happens when we have, the extremes of motion are either complete stability or complete chaos. But most of life lies somewhere in between, as you know from experience. And what I want to focus on in this talk is our studies of mixed phase space with cold atoms. In particular, the question I want to pose is, what happens if you have islands of stability where classical equations of motion constrain particles to be there and not to get out of them, separated by some sea of chaos? And the interest in that was theory that was started by Davis and Heller and then a long list of people since then, the last 20 years, who predicted tunneling. This is a form of tunneling between islands in phase space, structures in phase space, and they pointed to an effect which they call chaos-assisted tunneling. The take-home message that I want to give you is that this chaos-assisted tunneling says that you can have tunneling between states which is much faster than you might have guessed from naive calculations, from naive estimates. Your naive estimate would be that if you have two states, that the relative scale would be some exponential e to the minus 1 over h bar. Right? So as you go to the semi-classical limit, tunneling between those states is exponentially suppressed. What I'll show you here, the take-home message both in theory and on our experiments, is that is not true in this case. And it's not true because we're not dealing with a simple two-state problem. But in fact, we can get enormous tunneling rates when the states are very, very far apart. So the problem, to make that more specific, what we did is we considered one particular model. And that model is just a standing wave of light where we modulate the intensity periodically in time with some frequency omega m. And that amplitude just multiplies our spatial periodicity. And omega m is the modulation frequency, typically will be in the few kilohertz range. If you look at that expression, well, you see cosine squared times cosine, so you'll immediately expand that out. And what you find are three terms, three resonances, three versions of the pendulum. One is stationary in the lab frame, one is moving to the left, and one is moving to the right. And pictorially, the surface of section looks like this for each case. What I'm doing here is I'm plotting again P versus X, and alpha corresponds to the well depth, or just the intensity of the laser. And I'm slowly increasing the well depth. You see here, for very small well depth, if you just focus in on one of these, it looks like a little standing wave or a little pendulum. In other words, it has its own life pretty much. There's something funny going on at the boundary, but if we don't worry about that, each one has its own existence. And so if you placed atoms here, they would behave as if they're in their own standing wave. But what happens as we turn up the intensity, these lines start to cross or want to cross, and that breaks these invariant curves, and we get a transition to chaos, at least partial chaos. In this case, we have a region of chaos bounded by stability. So all the action occurs down here. We have two islands of stability at plus and minus momentum and one central one. And we can ask, suppose we put our atoms here, could we see tunneling? Now, what would be the signature? This is tunneling in phase space, but in the laboratory, this would be tunneling in momentum, because here we start out with some positive momentum, and we would expect to make a transition to an opposite momentum. So atoms would be going this way, and then suddenly they'll be going that way. And that's not allowed classically. Now, this is an example of dynamical tunneling. This is tunneling in phase space. There's not an energy barrier, but there's a classical dynamics barrier to tunnel from here to here, because you can't get out. This tunneling in phase space, or dynamic tunneling, was seen in my group and in the group and the collaboration between NIST and University of Queensland. One of the co-authors, Gerard Milburn, is sitting in the audience. I won't use my laser pointer to illuminate him. The experiments observed dynamical tunneling, and in our experiment we also claimed chaos-assisted tunneling, which I'll try to explain as we go on. And there's a review of this in August of Physics Today. So let me explain briefly how we did this experiment and show you the results. We start out by cooling and trapping atoms. In this case, these were cesium atoms shown here. In an ultra-high vacuum chamber, and schematically what we have is a combination of six laser beams going on the sides and in and out of the board, up and down, and magnetic field gradient. We can load about 10 to the 6 cesium atoms and get them to around 10 microkelvin. It turns out for this experiment that was not cold enough. So we then turned on three-dimensional lattice and did lattice cooling, where we cooled the atoms to about the same temperature, but now they were localized in little lattice points. So we could then trade off by adiabatically releasing them from the lattice. We could trade off their position localization for momentum, and that got us down to about 400 nanokelvin. That wasn't cold enough. So we then optically, and we found that out because we tried the experiment at each stage and didn't work. Not because we said, you know, we're not just masochists, that we just want to get the colder and colder, because there is some pain involved in these steps. So we then had to optically pump into the magnetic insensitive transition, because we didn't want to be affected by stray fields, and we used a method called velocity selective stimulated Raman tagging. What that allows us to do essentially is to pick out a velocity group from our atoms. Our atoms are cold, but they're not cold enough. What we can do is pick out something, and we can control the width of what we pick out by the duration of the pulse. And we picked out a group which was 1/20th of a recoil. So that's moving at about 1 centimeter per minute. That's pretty cold. That's a few nanokelvin. However, we don't have that many atoms left anymore, but that's okay. We've got more to spare. And we push away the ones that we didn't want anyway. And so we're left with this little group of atoms that are 1/20th of a recoil cold in one dimension, I should point out. So this picture is not entirely accurate because it's showing in three dimensions. We then do a step, which I don't have really time to describe, but it's a step of preparing a minimum uncertainty state in phase space. That essentially allows us to locate the atoms optimally on that island in a way that's the best way we can do, consistent with quantum mechanics. We then do our experiment, in this case expose them to this periodically modulated standing wave, and measure. And the way we measure is just by ballistic expansion. We let the atoms expand ballistically, and by doing that, we're essentially measuring their momentum. And what we're going to look for is a signature of atoms jumping from one momentum state to the opposite symmetry-related one. And we do that by turning on optical molasses. This is the same configuration as above, but with no magnetic fields. We freeze in the atoms and take a picture. So this illustrates, actually with realistic numbers, the initial conditions that we prepared. The upper picture shows the parameters where we ran. That's the relative size of the island. So we operated in a regime where the central island was essentially gone, and we have these two small structures. We loaded the atoms into this. Now, the reason it has this funny striped picture, it turns out that's consistent with starting from something that's 1/20th of a recoil wide, but turning it into a wave packet that fits also in in space in less than a wavelength. Because if you think about it, a 20th of a recoil is like approaching a plane wave which delocalized over 40 sites. And so we have to convert that somehow into something that's going to fit also in X. And we do that by adiabatically turning on. If you expand the view, you can see that the most of the initial condition is located in the island, and these parts are out. That's a necessary condition for describing that wave packet. When we do that, and the conditions are optimized, we see the following signature. And let me focus on the bottom one, which is more quantitative. We see that we start out with momentum, and this is measured in units of 2 photon recoils, which is a natural unit for us. To give you a scale, 1 photon recoil in cesium is 3.5 millimeters per second velocity. We then prepare them in one island, or where we think one island is, we have to verify that, and we expose them for some controlled time. And what we see is after different times, the atoms oscillate back and forth from that state to one that's at opposite momentum. And this effect dies out after about three to four oscillations. So this is shown graphically here. At least gives you a sense. You can see the momentum in this scale, time here. And you can see the oscillations which die out. Now, there were a lot of questions when we first saw that. We saw this effect back in something like last January. Are we really seeing tunneling? Is it sensitive to where we place it in phase space? Maybe we just see it anywhere we put it in phase space. If we move it, does the effect go away? So the first thing we had to do was to check that if we move it off in X, does that affect the tunneling? Because the island is located in X in a very precise way. We do that by putting in a delay in our state preparation. Turns out we can locate the island, the atoms on the island, or we can shift them off. Or if we wait a full cycle, we can put them back on the island. And the corresponding tunneling signal is represented here. I'm not plotting the whole distribution, but just the average momentum. And the tunneling, when tunneling occurs, that corresponds to the momentum center of the momentum average, momentum shifting down from its maximal value. Actually, if all the atoms were tunneling, this would go negative. But we see about less than half of the atoms tunneling. That's something else we had to address. But clearly, you can see that with no delay, we get oscillations. As we increase the delay, the tunneling goes away. When we come back a full period, they come back. So we can make the effect come back. It is phase sensitive. We can then ask, why do we work so hard? Why do we have to prepare atoms a 20th of a recoil? Could they have been hotter? Could we have seen it otherwise? So we've done it several things. One is to shift the slice, this 20th of recoil slice, and shift it up and down in momentum. And again, here's optimum. Here's where we see the biggest signal. Here's where we're 20th of a recoil, of two recoils rather, off, and it's down. Here's about a quarter of a recoil, and there's almost no signal at all. And that's clearly where we started from. Even with lattice cooling, we weren't that cold. And the effect goes away. Likewise, we can change the width of our tagging by the duration of our Raman pulse. By going to shorter Raman pulses, we pick out a wider velocity group. And in the same fashion, we can make the effect go away so that by h bar k, by recoil over 5, there's almost nothing left. By 1.5 recoil, where we were with lattice cooling, there was no effect. So this process is extremely sensitive. Now you can ask, what do we compare it with? And can we claim that it's chaos-assisted tunneling? That was turned out to be a rather controversial claim, and so we had to do more work. The first piece of evidence, which some people did not find convincing, but I'll show it anyway, is to compare it with a process where there's no chaos, a process that we think we understand, and that's Bragg scattering. So how would I represent Bragg scattering in this phase space picture? Bragg scattering is something you're all hopefully familiar with, but this is perhaps a little different way of looking at it. But in the phase-space picture, it would correspond to starting out in P and scattering to minus P. So it would have a very similar signature, except that our initial condition looks somewhat odd for Bragg scattering because it's not a plane wave, it's this funny wave packet. Nevertheless, we can still ask, what is that tunneling process? And the answer, first of all, we did the experiment. And the effect that we were seeing was we were seeing something that would correspond in our first experiments to eighth order Bragg scattering. That's a 16 photon process. And we saw with the chaos, we saw tunneling signature. Without, if we operate in the appropriate conditions and we tried it, there was no tunneling observable. Since then, we've actually been able to do a 32 photon process That's like a 16th order Bragg scattering. And if you calculate the time, by the way, I should say here, if you calculate the Bragg period, in our case, the experiment is about a few hundred microseconds, where here, the 8th order Bragg period would be calculated to be 1 second. Here, actually, we went to a 32 photon tunneling process, and the tunneling time went down. So it's actually opposite your intuition. We went to something that's less likely, and it was happening faster. But it was happening at much more sensitive to initial conditions and to the parameters. Nevertheless, it could happen faster. And the timescale for Bragg got ridiculously long. I don't even know if I believe that number. But the bottom line is we have a process that we have no other way of making it happen so quickly. But we have to check other things. And that's where our next efforts went. Because there were some claims about this process of chaos-assisted tunneling. One was that it should be extremely sensitive to parameters. The other is that there should be multiple frequencies involved, and we should actually see some evidence of the atoms flowing from one state through the chaotic sea as a transient and into the other state. In other words, it should not behave as simply as a two-state problem, but as a multiple, at the very minimum, as a three-state problem, where the chaotic sea is playing a role as an intermediary. That's what's effectively allowing you to do this. Now, this picture is maybe a little hard to read, and this is experimental data that took a long time to collect, and it's color-coded so that you can see it's the time, and this is the intensity of the laser. So each case here is one tunneling sequence. And you can see that whenever you see black stripes, that's the occurrence of tunneling. That's because atoms are disappearing from one state and coming into the other one. And you can see that these stripes only occur in some rather narrow range of alpha. There's some small range of intensities where we can see tunneling at all. But that tunneling rate also is very non-uniform. It doesn't have any universal scaling. Here I'm plotting the tunneling frequency in kilohertz as a function of this alpha, which is a portion of the laser intensity. The error bars get so big at these edges because the tunneling signal just goes away, and we can't measure anything. That's why we're putting very large error bars. But we find that it actually goes down as we go to higher intensities, which again is somewhat counterintuitive, but was one feature predicted for chaos-assisted tunneling. It also splits, it bifurcates at this point to two frequencies. There's multiple frequencies involved, which you would not expect from a two-state problem. And we could see that in the time domain in some of our data. Also, we had to answer this question, why were our first data set, we were seeing oscillations that died out only after 3 or 4 oscillations? Maybe there's some decoherence that we didn't understand. What we found out was that it was just a matter of multiple frequencies, because for some other parameter regime, we could see many oscillations. However, and for others, where we're in this two-frequency regime, we saw oscillations that die out and then revive. That's clear indication that there are multiple frequencies. The other thing that we could see was that the phase space, this picture that I described of phase space, is really a stroboscopic map that's taken one time every modulation period. But you could ask, what does it look like if you look on a finer time scale? And what you see in our case is that these islands are actually moving in phase space. So they move continuously. This is shown in steps where they move. And you can see that they're moving in x and slightly in p. In fact, if you were to look at them only in momentum, you'd see them bob. Each one would bob up and down in p. And they're moving anti-symmetrically with respect to each other. So one is moving up, the other is moving down, and so forth. So we look for that. This is what we saw. When we did the experiment, this is a very high-resolution scan, it's experimental data, of the tunneling that I showed you before. It's actually, this whole thing occurs in the first period of the tunneling oscillation. So from here to here, that's the one period of the tunneling. But on a very fine time scale, we see these fast oscillations, and they correspond exactly to the modulation period. So what we're seeing here is the initial wave packet is placed inside the island and is being dragged along with it. So that's a classical phenomenon. There's no quantum mechanics in that. But then after some time, it tunnels over to here. And note that when it's in this island, it's doing an equal and opposite motion. So we could we have two states which are each undergoing their own independent classical motion, but they are in a superposition. So we could call this chaos-assisted tunneling, or CAT, is in a CAT state. So this is a CAT-CAT. But also you can see that in between, there's some intermediary, that some transient, which is flowing and appearing in the chaotic sea. So there's no island here. That's where the chaotic sea is. And it's popping up there for some time, but then going away. You can see that even more strikingly in some other high-resolution data, where clearly stuff builds up here, but then doesn't stick there. Now that would be, so it's not just that it's decaying out of one island and meandering in this chaotic sea and somehow finding the other island. This is a coherent process, effectively a two-state process, but it's mediated by this chaotic sea in the middle. We've studied amplitude noise effects, and we found that we can destroy this tunneling. We can cause decoherence by, in this case, we induced it by amplitude noise on the standing wave. And what we found is we've done this now at different values of the scale Planck's constant. The way we can adjust that in the experiment is we just change the modulation period. But we can go to a smaller effective Planck's constant, and we find, perhaps not surprisingly, a larger sensitivity to noise. So this is the relative noise level, the percentage of the amplitude noise that we have to impose to make the effect go away. And at this stage, I think we have observed all the features of chaos-assisted tunneling that have been pointed out so far. The next direction with this experiment, and actually Bill Phillips and the Queensland group experiment already got into that in a sense, because their experiment was done with a condensate, and then one could ask, could there be many body effects that would change the results? And perhaps, I don't know, are there any you think that are observable? There could be some differences. So it would be interesting to go beyond the single particle picture, and it's really conceivable, and we're working on experiments to push that towards the many body regime and look at such tunneling effects when those are important. So I did want to make contact with quantum information, and what I've talked about so far, it's a far stretch. At least I don't know how to connect it. So let me tell you about some other things that we're doing, and at least one of them I think is relevant. And if I have a time, I'll tell you a little bit about that. How much time do I have, Carl? 10 minutes. Okay, good. That's plus questions or with questions? All right.
That's 10 minutes for you.
Okay, good. All right. So let me focus in on a few things, and I will talk about some of these in the talk next week. One of them is a new way to make traps for atoms. And what we've developed here, and also near Davidson's group in the Weizmann Institute, is to make a trap for atoms, which we call an optical billiard. These are traps in which we generate a pattern of light dynamically, like I am doing here. And if you do it fast enough, you can't tell that it's moving. Hopefully, right? If I do it slowly enough, you can tell. Now, with the atoms, we can do the same thing. We can fool them and make a trap where they think it's on all the time. But the atoms, we have to move it a little faster. We have to move it about 10 kilohertz. So they're a little harder to fool. But if we do that, then we can enclose them in a trap. And you might ask, well, why is this a trap? But remember, I told you that the dipole force, if we tune it to the blue side of resonance, it acts as a repulsive force. So the atoms that are inside, when they hit the walls, they'll feel a repulsive potential. And if it's strong enough, will be held in place. Now, we can confine them into two dimensions by holding them in a regular optical lattice. And then we can study motion in these two-dimensional traps. And some of the interesting things are that, as you may know, the dynamics motion in a trap, in a billiard, depends strongly on the billiard shape. And so for one of the first things that we want to check is, could we see the differences between a billiard that has one shape versus another? And the case that we chose to study was a wedge billiard. We just put atoms in a funnel. And we poked a hole at the bottom of the funnel and asked, how long does it take the atoms to leak out of that funnel? And what we found is that the answer depended strongly on the angle of the funnel. So for certain angles, they leaked out. For others, they didn't. they didn't find the hole. And so we had to figure out what was happening. We did this systematic study, and we realized that this angle, the angle where they stayed in the billiard, was exactly angles where there was stable periodic motion, where the angles where they escaped were angles that corresponded to chaotic motion. The next step with these optical billiards, again, will be to take a system that is not dilute. In fact, in our experiments already, there were evidence that collisions were changing the result from the simple naive picture. But our next step will be to go to a hopefully even a strongly correlated interacting system of particles, of bosons, or could be fermions too, in such an optical billiard, and look at the dynamics. Or you could, for example, have a billiard like that where they're strongly interacting, and then poke a hole and look at them escaping through that hole. And the answer could be quite different than what you'd get for single particles. Another experiment, which this was actually what I talked about at the Solvay conference because they were interested in those topics, but we observed an effect which is so-called Zeno and anti-Zeno effects. That is, we could suppress or enhance decay of an unstable system. In this case, these were atoms that were accelerated in an optical lattice and were decaying via tunneling. By repeated observations or measurements, we could either suppress or enhance the tunneling rate of those escaping particles. I'll jump over these things and get to the last three topics, which I'll say a little about. The one topic that we've worked on that is, I think, is relevant to this conference is an idea. So it's not yet an experiment. It's this theory that I've been doing with Chen Yu, a condensed matter theorist in my department, and Roberto Diener, his student. And we call this a quantum mass pump, or we've actually think of replacing that with a quantum tweezer. And the idea is how to find a way to extract a quantized number of atoms from a condensate in a deterministic manner. The method that we've come up with involves scanning a quantum dot of light, a tweezer, a focused beam, through a condensate. And as we extract it, we find, at least theoretically, that the state undergoes a series of Landau-Zener tunneling. But the bottom line is that we find stair steps, that is very high probability either of getting one or two or three. And it's in the ground state of this little optical tweezer. So that's nice because it means that if we can do this, we could extract at will, whenever we want to, let's just say to be specific, one atom at a time and hold it in this tweezer. That gives us the kind of control that one has traditionally with ions in an ion trap, or even better in a sense, because now one could move these around in pairwise, couple them together. And so it does offer some interesting possibilities for assembling atoms in little micro traps in ground states. And it's a different approach than any of the others that I've heard about so far. I mentioned at the beginning of my talk that I think that the optical dipole force is a general force, and it's not just restricted to atoms. And I think there's a real interest in using dipole forces to do other things. One of them is to develop general methods of laser cooling and trapping. So laser cooling and trapping is great. It's very successful. But the dirty little secret is that it only works for a few atoms in the periodic table. Right? So if you scan your memory banks and think what atoms have been successfully trapped and cooled, you can do a survey here. Well, the usual suspects are rubidium and cesium and sodium, lithium. And you might come up with a few more, but pretty soon your list ends. And so you could ask, what about the rest of the atoms in the periodic table? What about all molecules? Why can't we do anything with them? And I think there's a real challenge there, and we are working on ways, together with a colleague, Manfred Fink, we are working on ways to, first of all, to coherently slow supersonic beams, which we think offer unique initial conditions, which are already quite cold but moving very fast. If we can slow them down coherently, bring them to near rest in the lab frame, then we have a chance of cooling them further. So I think there's a real frontier there in generalizing laser cooling. The other direction, which has sort of been surprising, has evolved in my group together with Joseph Case, a biophysicist, over the past year. And it really grew out of a talk where I was talking about the optical billiards, and he's been interested in manipulating cells with light. And so we had this idea about a year ago that really cuts to the question of how optical tweezers are used. So optical tweezers go back many years. I think Ashkin proposed them in the 70s. And they've now become a standard tool of biology. And the idea is to use the same dipole force to pick things up and manipulate them. But our question was, suppose we use the light in a much more gentler, kinder and gentler way. Instead of trying to brute force move things around, suppose we take a process that initially would be isotropic, but give it some preference, give it some slight, maybe very slight preference, but that might be enough. And the process that we had in mind was a polymerization or growth of a cell. And so what we started doing last year is we asked the question, could we control growth of cells with light? And the answer is yes, we've done that. And I'll just show you one picture. I'm going to talk about this more in my colloquium next week. This shows you a picture of an accelerated growth of an axon. This is a neuron from a rat. Not any rat you know, but some rat. What we've done here, we've just shown accelerated growth. So this is a time lapse. Actually, I should really put this on a movie because it's much more impressive, but you can still see in the time lapse, 30, 42, 54, and 66 minutes, we have a race. In this case, a race between two neurons. One is, and we've done this many times, one in which we provide a guiding path. We basically draw a path like our billiards, except that these billiards are, to fool the neurons, we just have to move like this. Right? They grow very slowly. So this takes, you can see the time scales. We've been able to accelerate growth. We've been able to draw a path and make them turn corners and go in any direction that we want. And this is quite exciting because this is something that's not been, as far as we know, not been done until now. But it opens the possibility of making, of constructing neural networks with real neurons and other control of matter that goes way beyond, I think, just controlling atoms. So for me, this is sort of an interesting and exciting direction. So finally, I'd just like to thank you for attention and acknowledge all the people in my group who've worked on these experiments. Thank you.
Time for questions.
You show some plots of the average probability distribution, the average probability distribution, where you displaced your initial state away from the radio zone of the galaxy. I was surprised that you didn't see much movement in the average probability of the average distribution. I was surprised that
okay, I understand your question. Let's see if I can. I think what's happening is that the reason you're not seeing that kind of motion is, at least in some cases, like in this case, we've moved it off so that it's constrained now by the KM surfaces. Here, there's also some overlap, at least partially, with the KM surface. So that certainly constrains motion. If we had a bigger chaotic sea, you would expect to see just what you said. Yeah. And in fact, we have moved it off. I haven't shown this data, but we've actually put it all around here. And when we put it clearly in the chaotic sea, then it moves completely through it. Yeah. Good question.
How long is the
Oh, that's well. That's actually this is realistic. I mean, yes, it is the right scale. It is larger than the island. Yes, and we have pushed the experiment more towards the semi-classical limit. There still are. I mean, in the smallest k bar that we've operated, smallest scale Planck constant that we operate, we have about 20 states in this chaotic sea. So, I think they are quite well resolved. But one would like to push the experiment much further towards the semi-classical limit. And I think in principle it could be done. It's just a matter of, we don't see a limit, but there are technical difficulties. Yeah, I think that would be interesting, though.
Um,
Well, there's a simple picture, not in term. You can describe a picture in terms of, say, in terms of energies, avoided crossings in three states, and you could have a situation where, this really doesn't explain what you're asking. It explains more why you could get an enhanced rate, because you can have if you have one avoided crossing, the rate is determined by that splitting. But if you have a third level, it can cause by repulsion, can split them further apart. You can get a larger splitting, which means a faster rate. Ultimately, I don't know how to explain that except that those are symmetry-related islands. I mean, there is something special about that. In fact, when we walk it off in momentum, what we're doing is we're explicitly breaking that symmetry, and that's why it is so sensitive. It is an extremely sensitive process.
There's a two quick questions. The first one is a quick technical thing. Has anyone calculated the flow-based state for this?
Yes, several groups now have calculated that. Amari Moshe from Paris and Linda Reichel's group and a few others. Yeah.
Do you find stars sitting on top of those islands?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Because everything you describe is consistent with the approximately two-state interpretation where you have two Fourier states, one of which is symmetric, mm-hmm. sit on those islands. One is symmetric, one is anti-symmetric. And because there's no actual energy barrier, mm-hmm. the energies for those states don't have to get nearly degenerate,
yeah.
and that's why you have rapid tunneling.
Yeah.
So I'm curious why you call this tunneling when there's no energy barrier.
Well, that's, first of all, to answer your first part of the question, the Floquet analysis actually does show that that this is not a symmetric anti-symmetric pair. That in fact the Floquet states in the chaotic sea are involved in that. You must take superpositions of them. Otherwise, you could just consider it two states. The other question is why to call it tunneling. That's not my. I didn't call it tunneling. I would call it. It's a process that's not allowed classically, but people have called this dynamical tunneling. Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair to me. It's completely fair to call it tunneling, but it's not energy barrier tunneling. It's cam barrier tunneling.
Is the wave function trapped totally inside the cam barrier, or somewhere?
No. Well, as you can see, well, I don't know if you can see it here, but the there is some component that is outside the island structure. But that that is really a question of what is our relative scaled Planck's constant, and we have gone towards smaller values, but you know, that this is as small as we've been able to go so far. Gerald Milburn.
Just following on the Planck analysis, can you expect from your data sufficient information to give an idea of the parameters of the Planck spectrum from the tunnel?
I think in principle, from the frequency analysis, perhaps. We haven't been able to extract that yet, but I think in principle we could do that. The difficulty in comparing with theory is just that the fluctuations in the tunneling rates are so large, and there's uncertainties in the absolute calibration of well depths that it makes it difficult to quantitatively compare with the theory. But at least the trends are there, and we can do more analysis on this.
All right, let's thank Mark again.